Supreme Court of the State of Wisconsin is now in session. Your silence is commanded.
Please be seated. Good morning. Sorry we've kept you waiting. We are going to not take these rule petitions in their ordinary numerical order. Judge Faust has to return to the Dane County Circuit Court, he says. And as a result, we will take him first. I did not advise the others of the change because we're going to do them all this morning, and I was unable to calculate how long each would take. So Judge Faust will be the presenter in 10-11. In the matter of amendment of SCR chapters 70 and 33 relating to the administration of municipal courts. We have two appearances, one by Judge James Gramling and the other by Judge Joanne Earing, both representing the municipal court judge association and themselves. So we'll start with Judge Faust. Thank you, Chief Judge Faust, for appearing. Ordinarily, Judge Proctor, Chief Judge Proctor, would be making the appearance, but he's tied up in court.
No, he's tied up traveling between Augusta, Georgia, and Eau Claire, Wisconsin.
Now, Chief Judge Faust, a little faster. I really want to say that on the public record. Too late. I was being discreet.
He had a terrible conflict, and I was more than happy to offer to pinch hit for him.
All right.
Thank you, Chief Justice. May it please the court, it's an honor to stand here before you today. It's been many years since I stood at this podium. I am filling in for Judge Proctor, who was a member of the Chief Judge's Committee that worked on and studied the municipal court revisions that have been worked on for 5-6 years or so now. The legislative work culminated in 2009 Act 402, and today is, we hope, the last chapter, the last few steps in amending the Supreme Court rules to capture the Chief Judge's superintending or administrative duties with respect to our relationship between the Supreme Court and the municipal courts around the state. Roughly 240 of them now are now more fully brought within the third branch, and by virtue of the legislation and these rules, better recognized as separate and co-equal branch of government, or member of the third branch. The amendments that are before you are pretty straightforward and largely just say this is what the chief judges shall do in terms of administering the municipal courts. There is one sentence that I think is a little clumsy. 70.24 sub 2.
That is section 7 in your petition, Judge.
This section was added to clarify that a chief judge has the authority to reach out to a municipal judge or a reserve in a different district to have that person come fill in for a municipal judge in the assigning or appointing chief's district to cover for somebody who is recused or been disqualified or substituted on or suddenly has fallen ill. The fact of the matter is that there are some situations where the closest judge is not within the same district but is in a different district. For example, if the village of Dane still had its own municipal court within the 5th district, The closest judge to fill in for a judge in the Village of Dane might come from Columbia County, which is Judge Stork's 6th district.
Chief Judge, I raised this with you as we were walking in the Capitol, and this was raised by the LRB. And what I think is the problem in this is it doesn't have an introductory statement, such as you have in 70.24.1, sub 1. 70.24, which is now existence but named numbered 1, says where a municipal judge is required or requested to act. The chief judge then does such and such. And here, what's missing is that there is a request. When a municipal judge is requested or required to act, the chief judge, I think this is what's intended, and I'm sort of asking you whether I'm right. When there's a request for a new municipal judge, right?
Correct.
Okay. The chief judge, by order, may assign a municipal judge or a reserve municipal judge from outside the judicial administrative district.
Under sub 1?
Pardon me?
Under sub 1, to complete the sentence, mm-hmm. to make it
yeah.
clear?
To serve, or whatever they say. And then the chief judge may assign a reserve judge to serve in district other than them. Before making the assignment, the chief judge shall consult with the chief judge of... Now, does the third sentence here refer only to reserve judges or municipal judges?
I read it to cover both.
I do too.
Judge Gramling thinks that it refers to the preceding sentence and applies only to...
And that's why I asked the question, Judge. That's exactly why I asked the question. I could read it either way, and the reason I don't know how to read it is because the first sentence is odd, because it has this or a reserve judge at the end without any follow-up. So I think this is a technical drafting problem, not a substantive issue.
I think there's a little grammar problem in the first sentence.
Yes.
I think leaving or a reserve municipal judge hanging at the end of the sentence is improper.
Right.
And so I agree with you that it should read, the chief judge by order may assign a municipal judge or a reserve municipal judge.
I agree with that.
From outside the judicial administrative district. Yeah. And to answer the question, to do what, yeah. we should finish with under sub 1.
Right. The only reason I would argue against that is because if you look at sub 1, it doesn't make reference to reserve judges. So I'm wondering whether sub 2 only covers outside the judicial administrative district. And for that kind of assignment, you can use either municipal or reserve municipal. Whereas under 1, it just talks about assigning another municipal judge. That's my problem. That's my second part of my problem. So I've got a few little issues in that. And again, I think what after this hearing, unless we can do it beforehand, we ought to get the substance of what is really wanted. So it could be assign a municipal judge and reserve judge from outside the district. Who do you consult with? It seems to me you would consult with the chief judge for the of the municipal judge's district, more so if it's a acting judge than a reserve judge, right? Because the chief judge would have more interest.
That makes sense.
Yeah. So I just think that this is an issue that the substance of what is to be said has to be clarified. And then I think it's not too difficult to draft the sentences and follow what is done in one as a drafting matter.
I think Judge Gramling may be in a better position than I am to address what was intended, since I wasn't on the committee.
And
since we have foregone reserve municipal judges in the 5th District, mm-hmm. I can't even give you the benefit of any personal experience mm-hmm. with their use.
And I would like to say, since we have three, I may be confusing several in here, what is the effective date that's planned for this?
For the rules, I believe it's July 1.
July 1, okay. But that's fine. So we should do that promptly. Good.
Judge Faust, do you think that it could just say assign another judge to preside? Does it have to be reserve or active or specify that? Because whether they're reserve or active or not, I mean, that person's the judge in the case. I'm just looking at, for example, under 70, when you're talking about assigning for a circuit court judge, it talks about active or reserve, but in other sections it just says the chief judge shall provide for the assignment of another judge. I mean, wouldn't that be simple? Just think about it.
I don't know if some chief judge might then decide to appoint a circuit judge to sit in a municipal court.
Do you think, I mean, you know what? In Washington County, there were a couple of times, I'm just saying, there were a couple of times when the municipal court judge wasn't there, and I could go help out for a couple hours, and we would, instead of sending all those people home. So I don't know that a circuit court judge is precluded from doing that. I don't know the answer to that. I mean, that's what we just did
either.
In the interest of helping people get their cases done. But maybe that was wrong. Maybe that's not a possibility. I don't know if that ever could happen, if you were in a pinch or not, or if those hundreds of people would have to go home and wait for that person to have an actual municipal court judge from a different jurisdiction. I don't know the answer for sure. I'm just putting that out there to think about a little bit.
It
didn't happen a lot, but it happened at least once that I can remember.
Subsection 1, the 2B sub 1, says if you don't have a municipal judge, you transfer the case to circuit court. Now, the problem with a circuit court judge sitting in municipal court is the municipal court is set up by municipal ordinance. And I think you might have to look at particular municipal ordinances as to whether they would allow that.
So maybe another judge would provide for places that would or wouldn't. I don't know. I'm just putting it out there for thought rather than limiting it or having us worry about whether it's limited or not or having different interpretations of what you can and cannot do.
I think that there are enough municipal courts out there with flexible schedules that I've never heard of it coming up.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I'm just speaking from my experience.
So you thought this was easy, Judge Faust.
So far.
It's the wind-up and the pitch. Try this one.
I get to go back to my own caseload here in half an hour.
Are there any other comments or questions? Thank you very much. Ordinarily, we allow the presenter to do a wrap-up, but I don't know that that is going to be necessary.
It's pretty straightforward. If you'd like more history, Judge Gramling is prepared to address the history.
He's going to speak, and Judge Erring is going to speak. Are there any other people here who want to appear on 10-11? That's it.
Okay. Thank you. We think it's pretty straightforward implementation of rules necessary to complete what Act 402 has put into place already. Thank you.
Thank you. Judge James Gramling, retired Milwaukee Municipal Court Judge and Wisconsin Municipal Judges Association.
Good morning, Chief Justice and members of the court. Thank you also for the opportunity to address you on this proposed rule change. My connection with the rule is that I participated in the drafting and lobbying for the bill which became Act 402 and was privileged to join in the effort to craft a rule that would implement the necessary parts of the rule changes for the Supreme Court. So I've had some involvement throughout. Focusing on the issue that you've discussed with Chief Judge Faust, the intent of that section in the statute was to expand the options available to the chief judges when making assignments if a judge was going to be sick or at judge school or on vacation or whatever. So it was designed to expand options and not limit them in any way. I should also tell you that in Milwaukee County, this has been the law for probably at least 8 years, maybe 10. That is to say, about 10 years ago, the legislature expanded the options available to all the municipal judges in the first district so that a judge sitting in Fox Point or West Allis or City of Milwaukee could bring in a judge from anywhere in the state. And that was because, I guess I have to admit, in the City of Milwaukee, where we have, as you know, three full-time courts, we were having difficulty getting sub-judges as often as we needed them. So we needed to expand the pool, and the legislature agreed. So we were able to bring in judges from typically from nearby counties. So this has been a functioning practice for quite a long time, actually. Then when we drafted this bill, we said, let's expand this statewide for the mainly for the reason Chief Judge Faust mentioned, and that is because where there's a border, maybe easier just to bring a judge in from the other district. So having said that and addressing the questions raised by the court, I would say that it was our intent and our hope that the chief judge would be able to draw upon both sitting judges and reserve judges from anywhere in the state anytime a judge is needed, whether it's a recusal, whether it's an illness, whether it's a temporary vacancy, whatever the case might be. So to the extent in our drafting we didn't capture that intent, it would be great if we could capture it now in whatever language the court decides upon. So it would be helpful if we knew that the chief judge could draw upon anybody, anywhere, anytime. The sentence that's hanging out there at the end of that section, which, again, the court questioned Judge Faust about, we did not intend to have to place the burden on the chief judges to call another chief judge every time they were going to make an appointment outside the district. It just doesn't seem necessary or practical to ask the chief judges to do that. And I understood that sentence to apply only to the any time a reserve judge was going to be called in.
From outside the district.
From outside, yes, thank you, from outside the district. I just don't think it should be necessary for all of the other appointments. And may I just quickly add?
Can I just, we've got what is the old 7024, which is now sub 1, okay? Mm-hmm. And that authorizes the chief judge, right, to assign another municipal judge, right? The assumption is that's within the district. The assumption is that's within the district. Is that right?
I'll get the rule in front of me.
No problem. Yep. No problem.
I suppose you would assume that it means within the district. Probably, Chief Justice, when the law changed 8 or 10 years ago, there wasn't a corresponding rule change. I'm guessing that's what happened now that I'm looking at the existing rule.
Well, the thing that I'm concerned about is just that we clean it up. Because if you view what is sub 1 as referring to municipal judges inside or outside the district, that's fine. Then sub 2 should deal with reserve municipal judges.
It could be structured that way, certainly.
Or you can structure one to mean inside the district.
Yes.
And two to mean outside the district. And I have no vested interest in how it is structured. My only interest is to structure it so we know.
Sure.
And if the third sentence refers only to reserve municipal judges, then the word reserve should be put in, I suggest. Okay? So I think if I understand you, substantively, sub two is to allow municipal judges and reserve municipal judges to be assigned outside the municipality.
Yes, and outside the district, the judicial district.
And outside the judicial district.
Yes.
Aim that only with regard to reserve municipal judges does the chief judge consult with the chief judge of the other district.
For years on end, that there's not been a requirement that the chief judge consult the chief judge of another district. Again, it's only been in the Milwaukee County situation where the 19 municipal courts in Milwaukee County. But that hasn't been a requirement. I'm not aware of any problems that have arisen. So I don't think it should be a requirement where the typical kind of substitution or a substitution of judge issue comes up.
Your Honor, I am looking at that same language, that is the language of sub 2 and the three sentences of sub 2, that is sub 2 of 70.24 sub 2. I interpreted the need to consult to apply both to sitting municipal judges and reserve municipal judges. And I did that even though the second sentence just refers to a reserve municipal judge. I think I was tricked by the third sentence. That is, the third sentence reads, before making the assignment, the chief judge shall consult with the chief judge of the municipal judge's district or former district. And given that choice, I said to myself, what does that mean? I've said, oh, consult with the chief judge of the municipal judge's district, if it's a sitting judge, or former district, if it's a reserve judge. And so it is the third sentence, to me, that really informed what was meant by the second sentence. But you're telling me I'm wrong. So what does the... In focusing on the third sentence, does a reserve municipal judge have a current district and or a former district? Or how does that come into play?
A municipal judge who is retired or conceivably been voted out, but there's an opportunity to become a reserve judge. The application to become a reserve judge is made to the chief judge of the district within which the municipal judge served previously.
Mm-hmm.
And then the chief judge makes a determination whether to make that reserve judge appointment, typically for a period of 1 year, makes the call or not. I can tell you, Justice, that in some districts around the state, there was initially a huge reluctance and no reserve judges got appointed for years.
Mm-hmm.
Pressure was put on state courts, and eventually we worked out a solution. So reserve judges started getting appointed, but I don't think they've been appointed in every one of the 10 districts.
What if the second sentence is to mean just applying to a reserve judge? What does the third sentence mean? Does it apply to both a sitting judge and a reserve judge?
Your suggestion that I was telling you were wrong would require me now to say that you're right because,
yeah.
Because I think it, if I'm sitting here today looking at that language, I think I would interpret it the way you've interpreted it.
So yeah. For me, that's the problem because
I agree.
Yeah, the third sentence kind of informs the second. So
I agree.
Okay, thank you.
It seems to me that you should clean this up, and I'm looking at 70, 75103, to which reference is made, because all of this, of the chief judges of the Judicial Administrative District, is they are acting as my designee, that is the Chief Justice's designee, under 75103. And under 75103, sub 2, the Chief Justice has authority in regard to municipal courts, but not reserve judges, as I read that sentence. So anything you say here about reserve judges is in addition to any of the 75103, which looks like a court rule statute. So anyway, we're going to clean that up, right?
I agree. I would like to quickly add that oftentimes these assignments occur in such a routine manner that the chief judge isn't really doing much other than saying, yeah, I approve what you did last week.
It's done by the district court administrators.
And often the DCAs.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's
so it. That again calls into question the notion that the chief judge would have to consult another chief judge before doing this, because these are routine things that have been worked out in advance often. So with that, again, I think we ought to limit the extent to which we require that consultation.
Thank you. Do you wish to say anything else about this?
I wish to say thank you. Mm-hmm. Judge Eyring has allowed me to tell you that she does not have anything substantively to add to the conversation, but she certainly is available for questions. Thank you very much, everyone.
Any further questions to Judge Gramley? Good seeing you again,
good
sir.
Good to see all of you. Thank you.
Judge Eyring, do you want to add anything? Okay. Are there any questions of Judge Eyring? There don't seem to be any questions to Judge Eyring. Judge Faust, do you want to say anything further?
Ms. Vandercook from the director's office says we can go work on some language and have something for you by the afternoon.
Good.
The intent was that 70.24 sub 1 would deal with the in-district assignments, and sub 2 would cover the situation where the chief had to reach out of the district to pull a body into the district.
It covers reserve judges, and reserve municipal judges are not stated in sub 1. No. I didn't look to see if the definitions, if any here, I thought there were, in the statute would change what sub 1 does in terms of reserve judges. I didn't look at that. I should have, but I didn't.
We'll try to clear it up.
Yeah, if you might look at that and see.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Oh, I'm sorry. The Legislative Reference Bureau suggested that in 70.19 sub 4, that the language be the chief judge shall exercise rather than exercises, and suggested that its superintending be replaced with administrative, so the entire thing it reads administrative. And that's true of 70.20 sub 2, that superintending there is changed to administrative. I would add that in section 9 under sub 3, each municipal judge should designate and require a minimum of one municipal court clerk to attend the annual municipal clerk's training seminar, because we have a circuit court training seminars too. So my understanding from the material submitted to the court is that you all have no objection to the LRB's suggested revisions.
I believe that is correct. The use of superintending and administrative was simply an adaptation of the use of both terms from Article 7 of the state constitution. Judge Gramling walked off with my notes. I think what we thought of in connection with superintending in sub 19 But I believe that it is fair to say that the group did not have a problem with the LRB's
language. It makes it
more
consistent and probably in keeping with the rest of the SCRs in Chapter 70, as I see it. Thank you. And sure. I should apologize because I've looked at this. I looked at this in December before it went to the court. I looked at it when it went to the court in an open administrative hearing. Before it was put for public hearing, and I read right through 70.24.2, had no problem. And then yesterday, as if I had seen it for the first time, I had a problem. So I apologize to you all for not advising you sooner about this issue, but it's one that's readily taken care of. Yes, sorry, Justice Prosser.
Justice Siegler asked you a question about the assignment of a circuit judge to fill a. What's the answer to that?
I've never heard of it being done. Certainly municipal court cases have been transferred and handled in circuit courts for as long as the courts have existed. I've never heard of a circuit judge going and sitting in the municipal court arena as Justice Ziegler did.
Yes, technically you can make all the people drive a couple of blocks to the circuit court. It seems sort of silly when they're all sitting there waiting for their cases to be heard, though.
Well, 751032B says that the Chief Justice may exercise the authority of assigning and the authority in sub 1 is an active Supreme Court justice, a Court of Appeals justice, or circuit judge to serve temporarily as a judge of the Court of Appeals or any circuit court. Then 2 says that the Chief Justice may exercise the authority under 1 in regard to municipal courts for the purpose of, and B says, assigning cases in municipal court in which a municipal judge is incompetent, unable, or fails to act to another municipal judge, former municipal judge, or former circuit judge. So it limits it as to the occasions, although unable to act can be any number of reasons, although the first sentence is incompetency.
Unlike Judge Proctor, I mean, he was able to be here.
Right. Unable to be here, not right. because of incompetency, right. but because he was right. unable to act. Is that what you understand,
it's
Judge
correct.
Bass? Yeah, okay.
All right. Well, I'm not going to assign someone to replace him today.
Okay.
And so you can assign a former circuit judge, it says. If no judge is available, the Chief Justice may transfer the case from municipal court to circuit court. Then it says the chief judge of any judicial administrative district may assign any circuit judge within the district to serve as any circuit judge. So you have to keep reading, but I don't see anything else about municipal judges. So at least as of this moment, it says former municipal judge or former circuit judge when the municipal court is incompetent, unable, or fails to act. But you're not changing that.
I don't believe anybody intended to do
okay.
work a change of that. Thank you. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. And as I read it, it doesn't expand the powers because we're dealing with municipal judges and former municipal judges, so it falls within 751.03. Is there any other appearance on 10-11 relating to the administration of municipal courts? Hearing none, let me just conclude by saying to the chief judges and to staff and to the municipal judges, I know you've worked long and hard on the statute relating to municipal judges, which was adopted, and to adapt these rules to the statute. And on behalf of the court, I want to thank you all for your hard work, and the municipal court's judge statute and these rules demonstrate once again the importance of municipal judges in our system and municipal courts in our system. I think the materials we had indicated they handle something like 169,000 cases a year. So that's a lot of cases and affects the lives of a lot of people. So we want to thank you for your hard work on a statute and on these rules. And that concludes our hearing on 10-11 in the matter of amendment of SCR Chapter 70 and 33 relating to the administration of municipal courts.
Thank you.
I also should say thanks for municipal judge education and municipal court clerk's education. We hear only good things about these processes, and the materials we got include letters from municipal court clerks evidencing the value of these educational programs. So thank you very much.
Thank you.
All right, we'll now proceed in I guess we're going in inverse numerical order today, so I can handle it if you all can. We'll turn to 10-10 in the matter of amendment of SCR 12.07 relating to assessment of attorneys for the Wisconsin Lawyers Fund for Client Protection. Our presenter is Lindsay Draper, Vice Chair, Wisconsin Lawyers Fund for Client Protection. Before you start, Attorney Draper, I want to ask if there are any other appearances on this. I have none listed. Okay. Mr. Draper.
Members of the court, thank you very much for giving us the opportunity to present this petition on behalf of the Lawyers Fund for Client Protection. The chair of our committee could not appear, and I am very sorry for that. Deborah Smith is not able to appear here, but I am honored on behalf of the members of the committee to be here. This is a committee that, in attempting to present that best part of the legal profession, recognizes that at times there are lawyers who fail to recognize the total responsibility to clients and as a result sometimes engage in conduct that causes financial loss to members of the public. In looking at the rules and in attempting to administer the rules that have been established for the committee, there are two pieces that we are asking to have changed. One of those is to amend the rules to allow an annual assessment of $20 to be made for lawyers, and what that is a change from what amounts to a floating assessment that has a $25 cap. Part of the reason that we're asking that there be the annual assessment is to make sure first that lawyers know what it is each year that will be asked, but it's also tied to the second part of the request, and that is that the sufficiency level, the $250,000 that had been imposed under the previous law, the current rule, be lifted, that there not be such a cap, that there, in fact, be the ability, if there is money left over at the end of a period, to have that fund placed in a reserve fund, and again, to have this reviewed by the court on a periodic basis. The reason for that request is that there have been sufficient number of times when either the fund has had to defer claims to a following year when we have had additional funding come in because of the payment of dues by lawyers, or where there have been claims that because of their size, we were not able to address them. We had no ability to predict what the amount of money would be. We've either had to defer and had citizens wait to see if we were going to be able to pay them or if we would pay them, where we had approved the claims, or some claims we have just decided to consider at a later stage because we just did not have the funding. The number of claims, the amount of some of those claims, have indicated that we really do at some point have to address that, and the way that we have opted to make the request is to have the $20 annual assessment and to eliminate the $250,000 sufficiency level.
Now, have you gotten rid of the necessity of a $250,000 balance?
In the suggested, in the petition, there is a suggestion that the $250,000 amount be eliminated, that under, I believe, sub 1, would no longer exist. Part, again, of the reason for making sure that's not there, we are not in a position to want to accumulate a great deal of money. We do recognize, however, that there are times when the claims that would come in would just eliminate totally our ability to respond.
Okay. And you amended 1207, which is the certificate requirement, so I was just making sure that there's no other reference in these rules on the $250,000. I didn't find any.
Sub 1 and sub 3 are the places that I know of a $250,000 reference.
Right. Okay. That would have, and you've amended 2 and 3, so I think that looked okay. In 12.07 sub 5, you have the court shall review 1207 every 5 years. That's the assessment. To determine if the assessment and reserve fund is adequate to timely meet the legitimate claims of clients. My question there is, does that mean in 2 years, assuming we adopt this, that in 2 years you find you've gotten a significant number of lawyers with significant claims against them, and you really need a lot more money? Does that mean you can't come back in 2 years and ask for more? Because you've kept the 25 max, have you?
We suggested that $25 maximum be eliminated, that there be a $20 annual assessment.
Right. But suppose you need $30 in 2 years. Can you come back in?
The reason that we wanted there to be the 5-year review was, first of all, to make sure that the attorneys have a reasonable expectation, since we have set this as annual instead of maybe it'll be there and maybe it won't, that they have an expectation that they will not constantly have that amount raised. The whole point in the 5-year review is to, again, make sure not only that we are responding to what is needed, but also that there be the opportunity to say, we guessed, we based it on the data that we had, maybe we needed more, but also maybe we didn't need quite as much.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So you don't really foresee, unless it's extraordinary circumstances, coming back in except every 5 years?
That was, yes.
Okay.
That was the expectation.
I just wanted to know what the intent was.
The intent was to allow there to be predictability.
I'm sorry if I interrupted the flow of your comments and wanted to
proceed. I have a great deal more. I thought the petition is very simple in what it asks. The one piece that I did believe perhaps appropriate to address, since we have for a while gone at this limit, is to make sure that we were clear. And one of the concerns that we've had is that there have been claims that have been of significant amounts. And in many instances, it's not as simple as, for instance, wealthy clients having large claims. It sometimes has been as painful as, and the one that comes to mind had to do with a family that, as the family members got older and they had been taking care of a disabled daughter, set up a trust fund to take care of her when they were no longer able to do so. Yes, it was a large claim, but in addition to the money that was gone, their peace of mind of knowing that their daughter would be cared for was gone. Having to defer that to a following year when we had more money, yes, it allowed us to pay more smaller claims, but there were some people who tried to do the right thing, and we as a profession were unable to respond.
There's a limit as to how much you can pay on each claim, isn't there?
What we have had is a $75,000 limit that was raised to $150,000, but what we have also established is a rule that if there is a unanimous vote by the members of the committee, we can, in extraordinary circumstances, exceed that.
So this
is
a rule
very rare.
This is a rule of yours. It's not under the SCRs.
That's accurate.
Good. Yes. Any other questions?
Yes. How much in the aggregate would a $20 per year per lawyer assessment produce each year?
If I might ask the liaison from our committee, because I don't know for sure.
I'm sorry.
I know we have the 22,000 lawyers and at $20.
Roughly $450,000, give or take.
Thank you.
Is that right? Okay.
If all of the money that's collected in a year, say it's $450,000, is not paid out for claims of the type for which it was collected, do the monies remain segregated at the bar so that pool grows, or can they be used in the bar's general revenue fund?
The expectation is that there would be a reserve fund. It would be segregated. It would be used for the purposes of this fund.
Okay, so if there, say, the first year you collect $450,000, you have $200,000 worth of claims, so now you got $250,000 left over, and the next year you have another $450,000 in, and you got $200,000 worth claims, and I got $500,000 in a reserve. Is that what you anticipate, that it would just keep adding on like that?
With the scenario that you presented, that is what would happen. However, I would note that one of the charts that we shared with the court was that we have, for instance, already deferred $195,000 worth of claims for fiscal year 2012.
No, I understand your argument that you don't have enough money. My concern is the other side of the coin. What happens if you collect more money than you actually need?
It would go into the reserve fund, and that was really the reason that we indicated that we would like the five-year review, so that if, in fact, that type of circumstance occurred and it turned out that the calculations that, you know, that, for instance, what happened this time was an aberration, that we would be able to present to the court the ability to have that looked at again. Mm-hmm. That we really did, we have tried to see this committee as stewards of the funds of the attorneys whom we represent, and we want very much to not take money from people that we don't need in order to do what it is we're there to do.
Yeah, I understand the work of the committee, and I commend you all for it. My concern is more with the governance of the bar. You know, has the Board of Governors decided that this money will always be segregated, and so that's something that we can rely on, and if they
at the five-year review period come back and have extra money, then you may ask for a lesser amount per year. But they're committed to this set aside in a separate fund. That's the only thing I'm trying to get to.
That is my understanding, and there has never been a time that the money has been sought for other purposes.
Well, Mr. Draper, why don't we read 12.072B, which you've created. As of May 1 of each year, any funds in excess of those required for payment of approved claims shall be maintained in a reserve account, right?
Yes.
You think we have to add reserve account belonging to the Wisconsin Lawyers Fund for Client Protection?
If the court believes that that would provide the guarantees that are being sought.
I don't, but others might. Mm-hmm. Belonging to, okay. Do you have $250,000 today?
The current balance is, I believe, approximate. I did have the figure for the current balance. It's about $200,000, yes.
Okay. So you still have that as a cushion, and the cushion might be more next at the end of this year, at the end of the following year.
At the end of the following year.
Or it may be less.
There are claims that have come in. There are claims that we are continuing to get. We are going to need additional funding.
Okay. As a matter of fact, when I read your annual report, mentally, I declared you in bankruptcy.
We are quite aware, and it's been very difficult to know exactly how we will do this from year to year, and that's part of what motivated this. A good deal of the uncertainty, we do know why some of the claims have been deferred. Some have been deferred because there are other actions taking place that may influence what we are able to do or whether there's a necessity. But we also know that there are, at the very time that these pending claims are being looked at, there are other claims that are coming in as people learn of our account.
And again, if I remember when I read your report, you were paying percentages out on various claims.
We have attempted very much not to go to a system that shows percentages. We have tried to pay the total claim as best we can, but that is a yes.
That's right. It's a yes. My question then is, as to the ones which are prorated, I shouldn't use prorated, percent is fine for this. So if you paid 60% or 70% or whatever your percent paid, do you envision that at a later time, if you had funds, you might go back and pay more?
In those cases where we're able to determine this is the amount we will pay, we have tended to say to clients, if there is a point, for instance, that you have additional proof of the loss or the ability to show that you received, whether you found a receipt or whatever it is, that people can come back and ask for additional amounts. Okay. We do attempt to do that.
All right. I know that you've had unusual, at least from my perspective, unusual number of claims against one or more lawyers, and that has skewed your figures and calculations, at least as I read your reports, and we can hope that that doesn't occur again ever, but at least soon.
Part of what's been very difficult especially in looking at the profession is to know how one or two or few lawyers can so devastate things like the fund that it essentially makes the other lawyers look bad. One of the things that I have always been very proud of being a member of this committee is and wanted very much to have the general public know that lawyers try very much to make up for the bad acts of some individuals, but knowing that that's not what you would read about or hear about if we attempted to tell that story, people would want to talk about the bad lawyer and would highlight that one person who devastated someone's trust account.
My assumption is that you've already put in an amount for the bar dues statement that'll come out soon.
That's accurate.
And that was, what did you put in, $20?
I believe it was $20. $25 was the assessment for this year.
$25 for the assessment this year, which was the maximum authorized, but you're only asking for $20 on this one.
And it is because it would be an annual assessment is why we only asked for the $20.
All right. And what effective date do you want on this, or don't you care, just as long as it goes into effect before next March, April, when you have to submit your assessment to the bar?
I believe July 1st was the request for effective date.
Okay. Any other questions for Mr. Draper?
Thank you very much.
Thank you, and thank to Ms. Smith, Attorney Smith, for the submissions, and thanks to the members of the fund for their work here in helping people who have been victimized by lawyers.
Thank you very much for hearing.
Thank you, Mr. Draper. Any other people who wish to make an appearance on 10-10 in the matter of the amendment of SCR 1207 relating to assessment of attorneys for the Wisconsin Lawyers Fund for Client Protection? If not, this hearing is closed, and I will move on to the third and last hearing, 09-08, in the matter of petition to amend SCR Rule 10.035B1. The presenter is Attorney Steve Levine, and the only appearance I have is Roberta Howell, Attorney Madison, Wisconsin. Anyone else going to appear on this 09-08? Yet, counsel, do you wish to appear?
Not as to make any statement
Mr. Levine.
If it pleases the court, Your Honors, my name is Steve Levine. I'm an attorney from Madison. I'm here today representing the petitioners in this rulemaking proceeding. The purpose of this proceeding is to have the court decide on two suggested changes that the petitioners are asking in Supreme Court Rule 10.035B1. That Supreme Court rule sets out the nature of the expenditures that the state bar can spend compulsory dues on. And the two changes that the petitioners are asking in that rule is first, to strike the words political or ideological wherever they appear in the rule. And secondly, to insert some language to establish a burden of proof that the state bar must meet in an arbitration proceeding to determine whether a state bar expenditure is made for improving the quality of legal services or regulating the legal profession. Both of these changes come out of the case of Kingstad versus State Bar of Wisconsin that was decided last fall by the United States Court of Appeals for the Seventh Circuit. And to give the court a brief flavor of why these changes are being suggested, are being petitioned for, I'd like to just give you a brief description of what happened in the Kingstad case. In that case, the petitioners asked for an arbitration proceeding to determine whether state bar expenditure of about $100,000 on public relations advertising to improve the image of lawyers was made for purposes of either regulating the legal profession or improving the quality of legal services available to people of the state. There was an arbitration proceeding in which both sides presented evidence. It was decided on a stipulated record and briefs. And at the end of the arbitration proceeding, the arbitrator came to two conclusions. The arbitrator first said, I don't have to decide this case, And the reason I don't have to decide it is because the rule that's before me limits me to deciding issues where the State Bar is, has made an expenditure for political or ideological reasons. And this public relations advertising campaign was not political. So I don't have to make a decision in this case. But the arbitrator went on to say that on the basis of the record, if I were making a decision in this case, I find that the evidence shows that this public relations campaign was made for the benefit of the lawyers who were paying for it and not to benefit the public or the lawyer's clients. But I don't have to come to that conclusion because this is not a political expenditure. The petitioner sought a review of that under Wisconsin arbitration law in the Circuit Court for Dane County, and the State Bar had the case removed to federal court. The Federal District Court upheld the State Bar's position, and there was an appeal to the United States Court of Appeals for the Seventh Circuit. The Court of Appeals made 2 points in its decision. First, it said the arbitrator was incorrect. The arbitrator acted outside of his authority by saying that he did not have to decide this issue, that the words political or ideological in this rule made the rule too narrow. In doing so, it reversed a decision of its 14 or 15 years earlier in which it said that only political or ideological expenditures had to be considered in this context.
Now, so, that would have been a constitutional determination.
Yes.
Okay.
Second, it said, as to whether the State Bar's expenditure for a public relations campaign to improve the image of lawyers benefited the public, we don't think we're going to send this back to the arbitrator to decide. We want to decide the merits of this issue ourselves. And at that point, I pointed out to them, they raised this point initially for the first time during the oral argument. I pointed out to them, under Wisconsin arbitration law, the merits are supposed to be decided by the arbitrator and not by a reviewing court. And the Court of Appeals said, send us the arbitration record. We will decide this issue.
Now, as to the first issue, why was it removed under a federal question doctrine?
Yes, it was a constitutional issue.
All right. But now we're going into state law, right? I mean, that's your point about
yes.
The second part.
Right. Yeah, we didn't think that the court should be under Wisconsin arbitration law.
I didn't see a citation to Wisconsin arbitration law in that discussion.
No, they didn't cite any precedent at all.
Okay. All right.
In any event, they decided that...
Are we governed by their decision of state law?
Pardon?
Are we governed by their decision of state law?
I don't think so. Again, I'll get into this in a bit, but
okay,
this is a rulemaking proceeding where the court acts under its legislative authority.
Mm-hmm.
So I think the court can do whatever it thinks is fair and reasonable in this case, that it's not bound by the Seventh Circuit's decision.
That may be true, but of course we want to follow the law in our legislative or quasi-legislative authority too.
Right, but you can give more rights legislatively than the minimum required by the Constitution. In any event, the Seventh Circuit said that under a deferential, rational basis standard of review, the State Bar did not have to prove that this expenditure was made for purposes of regulating the legal profession or improving the quality of legal services. No proof was required at all. All the State Bar had to do was posit a theory as to how this expenditure could benefit the public. And if that theory had a rational basis, a logical basis, the court just accepted it in the same way that courts judge statutes, economic statutes passed by legislatures as to whether they have a legitimate state interest. That under that rational basis standard of review, the State Bar is not under any burden at all to introduce any proof. All it has to do is show a logical connection in theory between the expenditure and, in this case, improving the quality of legal services. And the Seventh Circuit pointed out the theory that the State Bar used was this, that if a public relations campaign improved the image of lawyers, gave the public a warm and fuzzy image as to what nice people lawyers were, then the public would be more readily available to consult lawyers and to follow the advice of lawyers. And that would actually be benefiting the public and improving the quality of legal services that they received. So that even an indirect benefit like that, even if that wasn't the main purpose of the advertising campaign, that was enough under the rational basis test to meet the state bar's burden. As a result of that, the petitioners have petitioned this court for two changes in Supreme Court Rule 1003-5B1. The first change would, as I said, eliminate the words political or ideological wherever they appear in the rule. And the state bar doesn't contest those changes. The state bar agrees those are necessary.
We're only talking about 1003-5B1, where they appear twice?
Yes.
Okay.
And as I said, the state bar doesn't contest that that change is necessary as a result of the second.
There's a filing quite recently the court got by email dated today at 8:20 a.m., and the state bar does not contest that that phrase, political and ideological, should be removed twice, as you propose in 1003-5B1. The dispute is about your other recommendations.
Yes, the second part of the petition to amend the Supreme Court rule would lay out specifically what the burden of proof the state bar would have to meet in an arbitration proceeding to prove or to show to the arbitrator that an expenditure was for purposes of either regulating the legal profession or improving the quality of legal services. And we ask that language be added to the rule to require the state bar to prove that the purpose of an expenditure is to directly, primarily, and substantially either benefit the public by regulating the legal profession or improving the quality of legal services, and that that burden on the state bar be to show the arbitrator by clear and convincing evidence. There are three arguments that I want to make, and the first argument, and I think the most important one, is that this proceeding is not litigation. This is not a legal proceeding. It's the court acting in its rulemaking or legislative capacity. And as a result, the court can adopt any standard of review, any burden that it believes is a fair burden for the state bar to meet in showing that an expenditure is for purposes of regulating the legal profession or improving the quality of legal services. There are two possible standards of review. One standard of review is the Seventh Circuit standard of review, which says there's no burden in an arbitration proceeding for the bar to introduce any evidence at all. All the bar has to do, if an expenditure is challenged, is to posit for the arbitrator a logical connection between the expenditure and either regulating the legal profession or improving the quality of legal services. Once the state bar does that, the arbitrator is to assume that that was the reason for the expenditure, just like when a state statute is challenged as to whether it has a legitimate state interest behind it. The court is not to look behind the reasons that are given for that, for adoption of the statute. The court is to assume that the reasons that the state offers were the reasons that the legislature adopted the statute, and the inquiry ends there. What we are proposing is something that we think is a fairer burden of proof. We're asking that the state bar be required by clear and convincing evidence. What's clear and convincing evidence? All that means is that the state bar be required to introduce some evidence as to what was the purpose of the expenditure. All evidence that's introduced in any legal proceeding is clear and convincing. You're trying to convince the finder of fact.
You know, I read this as the middle burden of proof.
I think that's correct. It's not beyond a reasonable doubt, something like that.
But it's not preponderance of the evidence either. Is that right?
Right. You're right. It's the middle burden between those two.
Well, what's the matter? One, if we just stick with the substantive language of Kingstead, which is somehow I have it in my head and I can't quite find it in my notes at the moment, that they use the words not only reasonably but necessary and reasonably. Is that right?
Well, they discuss, if I remember correctly, they discuss the word necessarily.
Necessarily, that's the word they use.
Right, but they said necessarily doesn't mean essential, life or death. It just means a reasonable basis.
Right. So, but we should follow their language. I mean, I would suggest that. And the State Bar submission, I don't know if you got to see it. Have you seen this submission?
I think I got it yesterday afternoon sometime. I skimmed it over. I didn't really read it in detail.
Well, their position is that they just want to eliminate the phrase, which you want to eliminate. But as I understand their position, which Ms. Howell will describe, I think, they say the bylaws take care of burden of proof, et cetera. And the court doesn't approve bylaws. I mean, the bylaws are not necessarily come to the court. But what if you said the burden of demonstrating an activity is necessarily and reasonably intended for the purpose of regulating legal provision or improving the quality of legal services? The burden of demonstrating shall be on the State Bar. And the State Bar shall meet that burden by a preponderance of the evidence.
I think, again, this is just off the top of my head, if you adopted language like that, it would be in conflict with what the Seventh Circuit said, because the Seventh Circuit basically said there is no burden on the State Bar of proof. The State Bar's only burden is to suggest a reason connected with either regulating the legal profession or improving the quality of legal services.
That's one way of reading it, but I don't think it's necessarily the only way of reading that opinion. And the State Bar's discussion of Leonard versus Ferris Faculty, which you also discuss, it says you don't need a direct relationship according to the State Bar, but there must be some indication the payment is for services that ultimately may inure. So it seemed to me, and there was other language I read that in the State Bar's memorandum that would indicate, here it is on page 4. The method adopted in Hudson, which is 475 U.S. at 302, which relied on Abood, the method adopted in Hudson to balance competing interests places on members the burden of raising an objection, that would be you in this instance, and on the bar the burden of proving that the amount of dues reduction has been calculated appropriately. So I read that. I didn't go back and read Hudson because I only got this morning, but I will, that the burden is... burden on Hudson is on the bar to prove that it's calculated properly. You can't calculate it properly unless you apply the reasonably and necessarily language. And the State Bar's brief on 4.5 says the burden is already contained in the bar's bylaws. The State Bar shall bear the burden of proof regarding the accuracy of the determination of the amount of dues that can be withheld. So they accept that burden.
Well, I think that the language that we're proposing lays out very specifically that the burden is on the bar and what that burden is.
I know, but it is a very strong statement of what's necessarily and reasonably by saying directly, primarily, and substantially, and taking the middle ground.
Well, let me give you an example to see how this would work between the burden of proof that we're suggesting and the burden of proof that the Seventh Circuit laid out. And again, I want to emphasize over and over again.
I think the bar may not be in total agreement with the Seventh Circuit.
Well, if not, that's fine. But let's take an example. One of the expenditures that the bar makes from periodically from year to year that was mentioned in the Seventh Circuit's decision as having been previously upheld by the Seventh Circuit as allowable because it wasn't political. Every so often the bar does what's called an economic survey of the practice of law in Wisconsin, where they survey lawyers and they gather information about how much lawyers are making. Perhaps that information might include how much men make, how much women make, how much tort lawyers make, how much administrative lawyers make, how much lawyers from big firms make as opposed to small firms and so on. Just an economic snapshot of how the legal profession is doing in Wisconsin. Now, under the standard of proof set forth by the Seventh Circuit, if that expenditure was challenged as not being reasonably related to improving or to being associated with either regulating the practice of law or improving the quality of legal services, all the bar would have to do is posit some logical relationship between providing this information to the legal public and either regulating the practice of law or improving the quality of legal services. It wouldn't have to prove that this was the reason why that survey was being conducted and why the information was being disseminated to lawyers in Wisconsin. So all the state bar would have to do would be to say, well, we're disseminating this information to the lawyers in Wisconsin so they know how to make as much money as they possibly can. This information will benefit them financially and economically. If lawyers are benefited financially and economically, the public is benefited because, first of all, if lawyers are making enough money, they can buy more CLE services, they can attend more seminars, they can buy more technology, they can better serve their clients the more money they have. So that a survey like this, which on its face, a person looking at it from a common sense viewpoint might say, this has nothing to do with improving the quality of legal services or with regulating the legal profession. The State Bar can posit a legal theory. And under the Seventh Circuit's burden of proof, that would be enough. You wouldn't have to examine any evidence at all. All the State Bar would have to do would be to posit a legal theory showing a connection between the expenditure and these two allowable purposes.
You know, there's a sort of strange word from my reading. It says, and you left it in, that the activities that are not directly, primarily, and substantially intended for the purpose. And then in the last sentence that you added, the burden of demonstrating that an activity is directly, primarily, and substantially intended for the purpose. So the State Bar doesn't have to show it's going to.
The State Bar doesn't have to show that. The State Bar can make an expenditure intending, say, that it improves the quality of legal services. Whether it's successful or not is not the test, right?
Exactly.
But we think that our standard of review is much fairer to both sides because it allows both sides to introduce evidence and for the arbitrator or the decision maker to make a decision based on that evidence. Was this expenditure intended? Is a public relations expenditure to improve the image of lawyers intended to benefit the public or the legal profession? Is a survey of the economics of the practice of law intended to benefit the lawyers or is it intended to benefit the public? It allows the arbitrator to make that decision. Under the Seventh Circuit's burden of proof, the reasonable basis test, all that the State Bar has to do is posit a theory as to whether there's a connection between the two.
You want, when you say talk about burden of proof, you really mean bringing in evidentiary matters.
Yes.
Okay.
The standard that we're proposing allows both sides to produce evidence and for the arbitrator to decide on the basis of that evidence. The standard of review adopted by the Seventh Circuit, it precludes both sides from producing evidence. All the State Bar has to do is to posit a theory showing a logical connection between its expenditure. That doesn't have to be the purpose of the expenditure. That doesn't have to be, there doesn't have to be a direct relationship. As long as there is some possible benefit to the public or some possible relationship with regulating the legal profession, that's the burden of the state bar, and evidence is irrelevant. And we believe that this court, in its legislative capacity, has the authority to say, we want a fair decision based on the evidence, not merely on assumptions. And we think that the court has the authority in its legislative capacity to do that. We also think that the
rational basis doctrine applies to legislation.
Economic legislation, not First Amendment legislation, which is my second point. This court, in decisions that we cite in our memorandum, and the federal courts have all said that when the issue involves the First Amendment, and it's a question of regulating speech based on the content of the speech, which is the issue here, because the entire issue depends on whether the content of the speech is for regulating the legal profession or improving the quality of legal services. When you have an issue or regulation based on the content of the speech, that strict scrutiny applies. And our language doesn't even incorporate strict scrutiny. As you said, we think it's a reasonable compromise middle ground. But we think that the court, at least, was incorrect, that when you have a free speech issue, a First Amendment issue based on the content of the speech, the courts have always applied strict scrutiny. And as you said earlier, Your Honor, in the Lehnert case, the U.S. Supreme Court did not use the test that was applied by the Seventh Circuit. The Lehnert case also applied a general public relations expenditure by a teacher's union. And the question was whether that expenditure had a reasonable relationship to the union's lobbying obligations. The Supreme Court didn't say, well, theoretically it does. The union argued if a public relations campaign improves the image of teachers in the mind of the public, then it improves the bargaining atmosphere so that the public will put pressure on its public officials to give teachers a better position in negotiation than if this public relations campaign hadn't occurred. The Supreme Court said no. There must be a direct, provable connection between whatever expense the union makes and the union's lobbying obligation. So in that case, the Supreme Court did not use the standard of proof which the Seventh Circuit adopted. But again, this is not a legal proceeding. It's a rulemaking proceeding in which this court can exercise its discretion and adopt a standard of proof that is fair to both sides, that allows both sides to introduce evidence, that does not just make an assumption based on a theory put forth by the state bar.
Counsel, why is the middle standard of clear, satisfactory, and convincing more fair to both parties than preponderance of evidence?
I think we're talking about hardly any difference at all. If the court wanted to use preponderance of evidence, that would be fine too. But again, this is a First Amendment issue, and the courts have always used strict scrutiny. And we thought this was a middle ground between preponderance of evidence and strict scrutiny. Now, does any of this have any meaning at all? Is this just theoretical argument about legal mumbo-jumbo that's not going to make any practical difference at all in how the state bar operates? We think it already has. Prior to the Kingstead case, the Keller rebate amount that was determined by the state bar was $9. After the Kingstead case was decided, which determined that the state bar had to look at all of its expenses to see if they were for purposes of regulating the legal profession or improving the quality of legal services, instead of just that fraction that was political, the Keller amount went down from $9 to $5. Instead of expanding, because the state bar had to look at all of its activities, the amount calculated went down to $5. So I would suggest that the standard of review, the burden of proof, does make a difference. That this very liberal standard of review, which the Seventh Circuit said the state bar only needed to meet, will result simply in an increased amount or a decreased amount in the Keller rebate because the State Bar has much more latitude in deciding which expenses meet both of those standards.
If we applied your proposal, and I don't know if you've done this, what would the rebate be in your opinion? How much? Have you done that?
I don't know. I didn't go to the session at which the State Bar Executive Committee calculated that Keller amount this year, so I really couldn't say, Your Honor. The other practical result of the Seventh Circuit's decision in this case, if the court does not change the burden of review, is that arbitration will never be used again. If the burden that the State Bar has to meet is so low that the bar doesn't have to introduce any evidence at all the bar has to do is suggest a logical theory, a logical relationship between its expenditure and either regulating the legal profession or improving the quality of legal services, no one will ever use the arbitration procedure again. The whole purpose of the arbitration procedure is to minimize the time and expense involved in deciding an issue like this. If the burden of proof in an arbitration procedure such as this that's adopted by the court as the Seventh Circuit's, then it simply won't be used again. And what will happen is litigation instead of arbitration, which will include the time, the effort, and the expense to everybody. So that by adopting a burden of proof that's reasonable to both sides, the court will be actually lowering the time and expense and the burden on both sides. So we would respectfully request that the court, first of all, strike the words political and ideological where they do occur in Supreme Court Rule 10035B1. And second, adopt the language that we have suggested because we believe that it is a fair burden that's fair to both sides, that allows both sides to introduce evidence to make whatever case they want and to have the arbitrator decide on the basis of that evidence. If there are any other questions, I'd be glad to take them. Otherwise, I think that concludes my presentation.
Without the language on burden of proof that you suggest, is it your view that the objecting party in the State Bar can or cannot submit evidence supportive of their position?
According to the Seventh Circuit's decision, I don't think it can. The first question, the only question the arbitrator has to ask is, of the State Bar, give me a reason why there's a relationship between this expenditure and either regulating the legal profession or improving the quality of legal services. And if the bar offers a theoretical reason, whether that was the purpose of the expenditure or not, whether there's any proof at all to show that that was the intention of the expenditure, the arbitrator just says, stop, that's it. All I have to see is some logical relationship.
Well, you know, I guess I read the Seventh Circuit a little bit differently perhaps than you. I didn't come up with any conclusion, which is why I asked you the question. I understand what they've said, but I didn't understand it as a preclusion from an objector putting in evidence to draw into question what the State Bar was saying as a reason.
Well, that's what happened in this Kingstad case, Your Honor. Both sides put in evidence. On the basis of the evidence, the arbitrator said, I don't have to decide this issue. But if I were, I would conclude that this expenditure was made to benefit the State Bar and its members and not the public. And the Seventh Circuit said, that's irrelevant. All that the State Bar has to do is to posit a theory of connection between the expenditure and improving the quality of legal services. So the Seventh Circuit was saying the arbitrator's conclusion on the basis of the evidence is irrelevant. All that the State Bar has to do is posit this theory connecting its expenditure with one of these two purposes. And all we're asking is for a proceeding where both sides get to introduce evidence. On the basis of the evidence, the arbitrator makes a decision.
The rational basis test is used for legislation. And the legislation ordinarily in Wisconsin, although in the federal system it may be different, the court does not get ordinarily a detailed analysis of the factual basis upon which the legislature acts, right? Oh, I think we think insurance policies, insurance premiums might go up. We think if we enact this, insurance premiums might go down. I think we enact this, there'll be greater safety on the highways. But no factual evidentiary bases. Ordinarily, sometimes you might get a study by somebody else upon which the legislature has relied, but not ordinarily. And the rule in, at least Wisconsin as I understand it, is that the court may, as you have said, support that legislation by factors that the court finds or thinks, right?
Usually, although there are some courts every once in a while that apply the rational basis with teeth test.
I've heard that before. I may have even written it.
You might want to look into that to see if this court might want to adopt that test.
I know that. And it's not unusual for courts, depending on the nature of the matter, to apply rational basis weakly or strongly. Also, there's some who would say that when you're applying and this is not a statute, I mean, there's no presumption of constitutionality or validity of what the state bar does, right? The reason you have rational basis is because you have a presumption of constitutionality. You defer to the legislature as the policymaking body. Correctly.
I would say there is a presumption that if the state bar posits a logical theory as to why its expenditures meet one of these two criteria, either regulating the legal profession or improving the quality of legal services, that's it. There's a presumption. The court said you must accept that. So there is a presumption.
Well, I'm questioning you as to how you can get from a presumption from the legislature to a presumption for the state bar. I find that difficult. Also, you've got the test here of germane or reasonably related to these purposes. And what you're doing is you're applying that test in particular circumstances. So it's not a, in any case, it's not an invalidation of the test. It's an if we were talking about legislature, it's not an invalidation of the statute.
It's sort of like testing the constitutionality of a statute on its face or as applied.
Exactly. So in each of these arbitration matters, it would seem to me we're testing the statute here would be the federal interpretation as a constitutional matter, right? That's the test. We're applying it in particular circumstances. And so there are some who would say when you apply the statute rather than a facial attack, there is no presumption of constitutionality. So the whole concept of deference and rational basis falls. I mean, there's some that would say that. I'm not sure I would, but there are some who would do that. So I'm wondering whether or not all of this analysis, as you've analyzed the case, doesn't fall. And that's, of course, your point. It does fall, right?
Yes. As soon as the state bar posits some theory without even introducing some proof as to this was the purpose of why we made this expenditure, all it has to say is this is a theory which could make a connection between the expenditure and improving the quality of legal services, then the presumption is it's constitutional.
What's the exact language from Kingston that you were relying on?
I don't have a copy of the decision here.
See, I didn't find a presumption in it. I didn't find a stated presumption.
It didn't talk about presumption.
No, but that's your position to us.
that as soon as the state bar posits a reason, there's a presumption that what they said was correct. And I just, you know, I read this a while ago, and then I just read it again sitting here, and I couldn't find a presumption, but maybe I missed it.
I looked at the language in this in part. I'm not sure is a comment that follows Justice Rogensack's, but Kingston says, I think it's 718 or 719, the standard of review is deferential, as when we review challenge legislation to determine whether it is reasonably related to a legitimate governmental purpose. Under, and this is the important part, this sentence, under that deferential standard, we find that the state's theory is not unreasonable. So that's what I hear you arguing, really focused on that language. Look, all you need is a deferential standard, and all you really need is a theory, and if they find your theory reasonable, you don't need evidence. Now, that's the language from which I hear your argument emanating. Maybe there's more, but am I correct? Or
yes, exactly. Like, let's take the example where the state adopts some economic legislation, and let's say the state legislature did it for reason A. But when it's challenged in court, all the state has to do is bring up any reason at all that constitutes a legitimate, you know, basis for the statute, whether that was the real purpose of adopting the statute or not, and that's enough to satisfy its burden under the reasonable basis test. And the Seventh Circuit is saying that's the same burden that's involved here. Again, all that we're asking, and we think this is a reasonable burden, which is fair to both sides, to allow both sides to introduce whatever evidence that they have and let the arbitrator make a decision on the basis of that. Under the Seventh Circuit's test, that wouldn't happen. All the state bar's burden is to introduce a theory as to why there could be a connection between the expenditure and improving the quality of legal services, and then the arbitrator's decision stops right there. As long as the theory is there, the arbitrator doesn't go any further.
Are there any other questions? With that, Mr. Levine, as usual, I will allow you, after others testify, to take the microphone again and set forth your position.
Thank you all very much.
Thank you, Mr. Levine.
It's always challenging being here.
And to us, too.
Seems like yesterday, Your Honor.
All right. Ms. Howell, attorney Roberta Howell.
Good morning, Chief Justice of the Court. Thank you very much for this opportunity to appear on behalf of the State Bar of Wisconsin this morning to respond to the petition to amend Supreme Court Rule 10.03, sub 5, sub B, sub 1. As has already been noted, I won't belabor the point, the bar does not object to the removal of the words political and ideological from the language of the rule. There's no dispute that that's required by the Kingstead decision. As you'll also note, consistent with one of your comments, Chief Justice, the bar has also suggested in the proposed rule that was provided with the materials this morning that in order to completely quote the language of the decisions, that the word necessarily or reasonably related to the purposes identified in Keller has also been proposed to be added in the bar's proposed revision. While we believe the language is sufficient as is to remove any doubt that we're quoting directly from the language of the appropriate decisions, the proposed revision would add that language. I think the discussion that I just heard raises a couple of questions and some points that need to be addressed. There's been a lot of discussion about
is it necessarily and reasonably?
It's necessarily or is the language of the decision.
Okay.
Yes. That's the language that comes from Ellis, Keller, Kingstead, and various other compelled speech cases from the U.S. Supreme Court. The discussion has been focused on whether the activities of the bar are for the purpose of something or whether they're reasonably related to something. The language of the decisions is whether the activities are reasonably related to the two purposes identified in Keller. It's not whether they were intended for a particular purpose or whether it was one of the purposes. So the standard that has been that's being proposed by the petitioners here is a different standard than what's found in the case law. The case law says if the activities that can be charged or can be paid for with mandatory dues are activities that are reasonably related, necessarily or reasonably related, to regulating the legal profession or improving the quality of the legal services available to the people of the state. That's the language of Keller. That's the language of Kingstead. And that's the language that's in the rule as it's currently adopted. With respect to the clear and convincing burden of proof, that just plain does not dovetail with a reasonably related to a particular purpose standard. It also, as Kingstead recognizes, the subjective intent of individual members of the bar's Board of Governors or a particular state bar employee are really not relevant to the determination of whether a particular purpose is reasonably related as opposed to whether it was intended for a particular purpose. Leaving that aside, however, with respect to this particular proceeding, I want to make sure that the record is clear. In fact, there was evidence of the purpose of this particular public image campaign. And historically, when the arbitration process has been used by the members of the bar to object to particular activities, there has been evidence provided as to what the intended purpose is, why a particular activity was undertaken, et cetera. For example, with respect to this particular set of activities, there was a record that I believe when we printed it out and sent it to the Seventh Circuit at their request was about 8 to 10 inches thick and included, for example, a study that was commissioned by this court with respect to the confidence of the public in the legal system. There were ABA studies relating to the same issue. There were academic studies relating to the same issue. All of those studies were considered by the bar and were part of the reason for the adoption of the activities that went forward. And, in fact, the ABA had specifically recommended a particular type of public image campaign in order to accomplish the purpose, which was to increase the public confidence in the judicial system, taking it one step at a time, starting with confidence in lawyers who then are the face to most members of the public of the judicial system.
Counsel, you indicated to the court the substantial record in this arbitration. Yet as I review the Kingstead case, I think there is merit to your opposing counsel's argument that in the future there need be no testimony taken at an arbitration hearing. One of the things that he advances is that under the Kingstead case, that rather than having arbitration work, I mean, there's no incentive to do anything other than just litigate. And the language of the Kingston case that I see seems to support his assertion that in the future, arbitration doesn't have to have any testimony. I want to read the couple of sentences that I'm referring to, and then talk to me, if you will, and to the court, about whether or not he's correct in the future. You need any testimony presented.
If I might, it's the Kingston case is on tab 5 in our materials. And what page? There's a page number at the top right corner.
Page 10.
Good.
And I'm looking at the right-hand column. You don't have that, but the other justices do.
It's on page 719, 622 Federal 3rd, 719, if you have that.
I do, in front of me.
Okay, thank you. Justice?
I'm speaking on page 719, and then to the other justices if they're following, the very top of the right-hand column that starts in response to the dissent. Our dissenting colleague finds that theory to be speculative and unsupported by the record. We do not suggest that the theory is beyond debate. Now they're talking about the theory of the state bar as to how it in the advertising campaign enhances the delivery of legal services. And then I, just for ease, skip a sentence or two, I guess a sentence, and pick up. We do not assert that the record shows the public image campaign has actually improved the quality of legal services, but we do not see a need for a trial that would scrutinize either the subjective motives of bar leaders or the actual effectiveness of the public image campaign. And then it continues, the standard of review is deferential, as when we review challenge legislation to determine whether it is reasonably related to a legitimate governmental purpose. Finally, under that deferential standard, we find that the state bar's theory is not unreasonable. I interpret that language to mean, yeah, number one, there's a deferential standard. Number two, all they need, the state bar needs, is a theory. And number three, you don't need a trial because we're not concerned about whether or not it has actually improved the legal services, or and we don't need a trial that would scrutinize either the subjective motives of bar leaders or the actual effectiveness of the public image campaign. That's how I interpret it. Deferential. All the state bar needs is a legal theory that's not unreasonable, and you don't need a trial. Am I right or wrong in that interpretation of that section?
I think that from a federal constitutional perspective, the standard that's that is described here, and as you describe it with your three factors, is the correct one, because the strict scrutiny that went with the First Amendment implications has already been applied in determining that a mandatory bar is constitutional in the first instance. As the Ellis and the Keller and the Leonard and now Kingstead cases say, the question when we're talking about any particular activity is whether that activity is germane, is it reasonably related to those two purposes, and does it impose any additional impingement on the First Amendment rights of the objectors? So when we're looking at those two questions, the question is, when we're determining whether it's germane, is it reasonably related? Not whether it was intended for a particular purpose, but is it reasonably related? And that's where the deferential standard comes in. I think as a practical matter, there's two issues here. One is, when you're looking at activities like this one, which are intended to have a long-term effect, there's not going to be empirical evidence immediately that says it had that effect. So you have to say, does it make sense that it will have that impact? And is there some evidence to support that logical connection? And that's, in fact, what we had in this case. I think the second aspect of this is that and it depends on the activity that's involved, but some activities are simply not going to have any additional First Amendment implications. And so the standard of review in those situations would be that much more deferential because there's no First Amendment implication. An example comes from the Ellis case. Again, I go back because that's the case that you see repeatedly cited through all of these compelled association cases. But in Ellis, one of the things that was challenged was the union's conventions. Court found there was no additional First Amendment implications because of the fact that there was a convention. Simply the objection was that it was a union activity and therefore the objectors objected to their dues being used for that purpose. Since there was no additional First Amendment impingement on the objectors' rights by that activity, there was really no analysis of whether it was related to anything. It was simply found to be chargeable. There's a continuum in terms of the deference and the review that's given to the activities, and it's set out in the Kingstead decision in the sense of If it's germane, then the other question is, does it have an additional impingement on First Amendment rights? In a practical sense, the way the bar handles that, and I've now sat through, I think it's 6 executive committee all-afternoon meetings as we review every single activity of the bar over the previous year to determine whether it's going to be considered chargeable or non-chargeable for the next year's dues rebate. When it comes to things like lobbying, a much more careful scrutiny is given by the members of the executive committee to determine whether not only is it sort of in a very generic sense reasonably related, but is there a real connection between the particular activity and the two purposes identified in Keller? If we're talking about something as simple as reporting on a particular issue as opposed to taking a position or communicating a position of the bar or one of its committees, that's a different issue. But the bar, as a practical matter, takes this standard that's set forth in Leonard and has been in the cases, Abood and Ellis and Keller and Hansen and Street, seriously, and reviews each activity to say, is it related? And particularly if it's a political or ideological issue, even this year when those words were not used as part of the test, how closely is it related to those issues?
Counsel, if I may, just as a follow-up then, in the future, under the Kingston test, is there any requirement for evidence to be presented at arbitration hearing?
I think that will depend on the issue or the activity that is being objected to. If this is an activity that has a more political or ideological or some other First Amendment implication, I think the evidence that it is related to those two purposes will need to be offered, and what that level will be will depend on the level of impingement. But I think the way this test is set out in Kingstead and as it was applied here, I think the answer is it depends.
You know, I think I look at Kingston, and it's very clear what the test is because it says, and I quote, the test here is whether the challenged expenditures were necessarily or reasonably incurred for the constitutionally legitimate purposes that authorize mandatory dues. And so I don't know why you can't litigate the reasonableness before an arbitrator. I don't see any preclusion in the case that prevents that.
And
that's
true. And that's, in fact, what has happened in the arbitrations that have taken place. The standard, the reasonably related to the purposes set forth in Keller, that's been the standard since this rule was adopted when the reintegration or the suspension of the integrated bar was lifted.
Ms. Howell, why then do we use the word intended instead of incurred?
There are different places in different cases where the two words are used in different ways, and the language that's in the rule is the language as it came out of Keller, and that's why
the language that was just read out of Kingston was incurred, not intended.
That's true. That it did come out of the incurred. It was actually spent for that purpose, or was reasonably related. It was an expenditure made that was really reasonably related to those purposes. If you look at different places in the different cases, the verbal formulation is slightly different.
So you say intended and incurred are the same.
They can be, yes.
So do you agree that the burden of demonstrating an activity is necessarily or reasonably incurred for the purpose of regulating a legal profession or improving the quality of legal services is on the bar, state bar? Do you agree with that?
Determining whether the calculation was correctly made, which includes the test, is what Hudson says.
Okay.
And so that's what it's been in the bar's bylaw.
So you don't have any objection to the last sentence as long as we don't use the word directly, primarily, and substantially, and we take out clear and convincing, right?
That's correct. Okay. That's what's in the bylaw.
Now, suppose I said shall be on the state bar and shall be met by, and we could say either the preponderance of the evidence or clear and convincing evidence or strict scrutiny, depending on the issue.
I think the
that's what you said here, as I heard you.
I don't think I would go quite that far. What the cases say is that it's a sliding scale. It's not a particular test. It's a sliding scale. So the greater the impingement, the closer the relationship, but it's not a specific test.
Well, what I'm trying to get, and I accept that for the moment, is a test. I think it would be healthy to put it into an SCR rather than leave it for the bylaws, which the court has no control over, right?
Well, I believe the court does review the bar's bylaws and can can prevent them from going into
effect. So they'd bring in these bylaws.
That's correct.
I'd still like to see it right up against this so that we don't have to look at two different things. So I would like to have language that says the burden of demonstrating an activity is necessarily or reasonably intended or incurred for the purposes, blah, blah, shall be on the state bar. And what's the language you would propose that the burden is a sliding scale burden from preponderance through strict scrutiny depending on the issue?
I'm trying to think how Leonard describes it and how it's been applied in some of the other cases to try to provide you some specific language.
That's going to help the bar. It's going to help the arbitrator. It's going to help the objectors.
The way that the cases read is that to the extent that there is an additional impingement, that the activity that's at issue imposes an additional impingement on the First Amendment rights of the objectors, the connection to the purposes identified in Keller need to be closer. So the greater the impingement, the greater the connection. I'm not quite sure how you turn that into a burden of proof.
Well, you're going to have time to think about it over the lunch hour. I hope.
Okay.
All right? And you may just leave it, she'll be on the state bar, and then say, I think it can be done, if that's what you think the burden is.
That's
and you think it should, there is a hearing, and it is evidentiary.
That's, in fact, what has happened, and I do believe that, I mean, as counsel to the bar, I can't imagine going in an arbitration and not having some evidence to support the reason why the bar undertook a particular activity.
So you won't have any objection to saying that?
I don't believe so. No,
are you
I'm not sure what saying exactly what, but
that is evidence.
I personally don't have an objection, yeah. But I mean, in terms of what the Bar's Board of Governors has to make a particular.
I understand that. The arbitration is in what section?
The arbitration, which provision? There's some under 10035B3, and there's some in the bar's bylaws.
Okay. I think reference might be made, since arbitration is required, isn't it?
It is required.
Right. That in the arbitration, that it's viewed as an evidentiary hearing.
I believe that the ability to present evidence is already in the procedures for that as well, but let me...
Bylaws or...
I believe it's in the bylaws.
I've got the bylaws open in front of me.
Yes, it's in Section 5 of the bylaws, subsection E.
Article 1, Section
yes,
5,
sorry.
Right?
Article 1, Section 5, sub
and that
E.
That covers all of this. Sub...
Sub E. And it is the last sentence, the second to the last sentence before the subparagraphs further. It says all parties will be given the opportunity.
Start with the sentence above that. The
state bar shall bear the burden of proof regarding the accuracy of the determination of the amount of dues that can be withheld.
And you include an accuracy application of the test. Because you can't determine accuracy unless you're applying the germane test, the reasonably related test, right? It's not just the numbers.
Well, it depends on the objection.
Okay.
And we have had objections that sort of both object to particular activities and how the amount was calculated. So I think the reason the language is more generic is it covers any objection.
Okay. But it includes that concept.
I think
well,
that
the problem with the language about given the opportunity doesn't get to the argument here that the standard of review at Kingston omits the necessity.
And I'm not sure that Kingstead does that. I think it depends, again, on the level of additional impingement. I think if a particular activity is challenged that doesn't add an additional impingement on the First Amendment rights, I think it would be true that Kingstead would say nothing more than, as long as it's logical, we're fine with that. I think it would be different if we were talking about, for example, if the bar were out there doing what the State Bar of California were doing in the Keller case, which was lobbying on apartheid and gun control and a whole variety of issues that were separate and apart, and the question then becomes, how closely is that related to the purposes?
And you don't have to, do you have to put in any evidence on that?
I think you would, because of the additional impingement that's involved in the First Amendment.
No impingement here, right? No impingement. Did the PR campaign, does that impinge on the First Amendment?
There was no discussion of that, and in my view, given what was in those things, I don't think it did.
No, I didn't think so either. So we're now outside of the First Amendment. So does the bar have to put any evidence in that the expenditures for PR are necessarily or reasonably intended or incurred for the purposes of regulating or improving?
Does it have to constitutionally? I don't think so. I
think to win, to bear its burden. We agree that the State Bar has a burden, right? Mm-hmm. The bylaws now say that. So to win, can they just sit pat, not say anything, or is that a default?
The bar has to defend the activities that it was involved in, and the bar is going to have evidence of what it did and why, so I can't imagine it not putting in evidence as a legal matter, whether it's required to.
If it's required, in an ordinary case, if the plaintiff...
You can put in some evidence.
The burden, yeah, person that has the burden puts in no evidence, you lose.
Yeah, you have to put that's in some evidence, yes.
That's all I'm trying to...
Okay. Yeah,
the bar has to put in evidence. All right. So we have to say that, I suggest. I suggest it. That's one vote. Okay. You have been interrupted.
No, that's fine.
You may proceed.
The Hudson Court basically set out the framework for arbitration procedures like the one here today, or that we're discussing here today, that balances the rights of the bar and its members who do not object to particular activities and the use of those activities, the use of their dues for particular activities, and the rights of those who object to particular uses. And the purpose of the arbitration proceeding is to balance those two rights. The bar, as an entity, has specific rights and obligations, and its members have specific rights and obligations under the First Amendment, as do the objectors. And so the purpose of the arbitration proceeding and the test that is being applied is to balance those two rights by attempting to impose the very high standard that the petitioners are suggesting. That tips the balance too far against the bar and the non-objecting members for their dues to be used for those purposes that they have, that the bar has made a determination through its Board of Governors and its various policy-making entities to spend its money on. The language of the cases doesn't require that, and in addition, it offsets that balance that Hudson sets in terms of how we go forward in this. The clear and convincing standard that's suggested also ignores the language of Hudson, which makes it clear that precision is not required in this determination, that a certain flexibility is necessary for the bar, like the unions, to do their job and to fulfill their purposes. The test that's set forth in SCR 035B1, as proposed by the bar, is the test that comes directly out of the language of the cases. Going beyond that, in my view, upsets the balance set forth in Hudson, is not required by the cases, and actually it goes too far and actually impinges on the First Amendment rights of the bar and the members who are not objecting. Obviously, the objectors' rights are important. They're very of paramount importance, and they need to be protected, but we can't forget the other side of the equation as well, and I think that the standard that's proposed does that.
I know the bylaws are not before us, right? But the bylaws say, and this is an amendment to the bylaws, that when you have constitutional rights, review of the arbitration award shall be de novo.
That's correct.
Is that in keeping with the Wisconsin statutes?
No, but that's required by Hudson.
Okay. What else in the bylaws are required by a statute, by a case law?
Hudson requires, has a basic framework that says a reasonably prompt review by an impartial decision maker. That's the arbitration process itself. And the way that the arbitrator is appointed, although I believe that may be in the, no, that's here, that's in the bylaws, is appointed by the Federal District Court. It requires that the bar members have the opportunity to review records on which the calculation is based, if that's reasonably required by their objection. That's included in the bylaws under sub D. And it requires that there be an opportunity for judicial review on a de novo basis of constitutional issues, and that's what's in here.
So if this, in this case, Kingston, where the objection is that PR is not necessarily or reasonably incurred or intended for the purpose of regulating the profession or improving the quality of legal services, is that a First Amendment, is that a constitutional right?
Under Keller, yes. The question is whether those activities are reasonably related to those two purposes.
So in most cases then, after arbitration, it's de novo. Is that right?
In most cases, that is correct. There have been challenges over the years that were related to whether the amount spent was X versus Y and that type of thing in some of the early arbitrations. So there are
dollars, yeah.
Correct. There are potential for those issues to happen.
How much was spent on PR? That might be a debate. So, but most of them will not. So what's the point of arbitration?
The point of arbitration, as Hudson posits it, is to have a prompt decision so that the objectors can decide, can have their position heard. And this is the first one, frankly, that's been appealed. Previous arbitrations, the arbitration went forward, it was concluded promptly, and there was an adjustment made in the amount of the dues reduction that was done, and the arbitration was over. It was very prompt, and it was and to the point. This one took longer because it's gone up through the process.
Are there any other questions? And if there are, I'm going to hold them to after lunch because I'm going to speak further. Not about this subject during lunch hour. All right? The court will reconvene at about 1:30. Might turn out to be 1:35. Right?
Thank you.
Mr. Levine, if you wish, you may then speak. Ms. Howell, if you wish, you may continue.
I think unless the court has any other questions on my presentation.
No. Or you may have something you want to add as a result of communications during lunch. Thank you. Court's in recess till about 1:30.